Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is SOD 2 of For the Record Program Number 587, Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This is being recorded on February 25th of the year 2007. We're going to plunge right into the discussion and resume with the basic topic that we left off with on side one. We were talking about Sammy Al-Aryan, or Sammy the Aryan as I call him, an individual very closely associated, actually one of the more influential members of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, an individual the investigation into whom led to the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002. One of the things those raids turned up was what might be called the Muslim Brotherhood or terror lobby within the GOP, a significant element of intersection between the Islamo-fascist Muslim Brotherhood, the parent organization of Al-Qaeda Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Republican Party, and the Bush administration. Indeed, the lobbyist for Sammy Al-Aryan was none other than Grover Norquist, an individual who himself may very well have converted to Islam, and who certainly has married a Palestinian Muslim woman. Norquist, arguably the linchpin, along with Karl Rove, of the GOP right wing. And so when we see basically Sammy the Aryan, as I call him, getting off on a technicality after the judge instructed the jury that they could only convict him if it could be proved that the monies he had generated for Palestinian Islamic Jihad were specifically used for terrorism, and how the hell are you going to prove that? Well, Sammy the Aryan got off. He refused to testify before a grand jury about the IIIT, saying that his life would be in danger if he did. It certainly suggests that the IIIT is not a benign organization. But when you look at Sammy the Aryan, hailed as a martyr by the political sector, lionized on Pacifica Radio, among other institutions, remember that not only is this guy a terrorist, but he is Bush's buddy. His lobbyist is Grover Norquist. So very strange days indeed. Indicative of the really shocking extent to which venality and treason, fascism, and anti-Semitism have been able to work their way into not only academia, but the so-called progressive sector through the most unfortunate identification of the so-called progressive sector with Islamist culture. And I'm not talking about Muslims. I'm talking about Islamism specifically, militant Islam, or in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic fascism. Something that indicates the just how far beyond the pale this whole thing has gone concerns a press release that was generated at Stanford University. Specifically, there was an event, a showing of a Turkish movie, Valley of the Wolves, Iraq, which has a modern reworking of the old blood libel gambit that was used to justify anti-Semitism and actual pogroms in medieval Europe, namely the notion that Jews kidnapped Christian, and also this is now disseminated in the Middle East, that the allegation that Jews kidnap Muslim babies and kill them, or Muslim children and kill them, and then drain their blood to mix into matzah. A slight modern reworking of that found its way into a Turkish movie called Valley of the Wolves, Iraq. Gary Busey, of all people, plays a Jewish-American doctor who, after killing Muslim babies or Muslims who had children who were kidnapped, then harvests their organs to be sold in the United States. To condemn such a movie is not, of course, to endorse the tragic events now unfolding in Iraq, and it's sad, frankly, to see opposition to the Iraq War or disenchantment with the Bush administration, both of which I couldn't say I was disenchanted with the Bush administration. I was never enchanted with it. I voted for Al Gore in 2000, and if you go back and listen to For the Record 248, the first program I did about the campaign, I warned about what I felt would take place if George Bush became president, and you go back and listen to that program and you see how much of it has in fact taken place. Or you can listen to For the Record 510, in which I recapped a lot of that program and showed how the things that I was afraid would take place have in fact taken place, including the disastrous Iraq War and a whole lot of other things. But it is sad to see resentment against the Bush administration or opposition to the Iraq War feeding the sort of BS that is being fed. Now, again, one should understand that Stanford University, one of America's premier educational institutions, was not only showing this movie, but the movie was represented in a very positive light. I'm going to read the press release that Stanford University put out. This event was co-sponsored by the Middle East Collection of the Stanford University Libraries, the Abbasi ABASI Program in Islamic Studies, and Stanford Continuing Studies. And this is how they represented the movie Valley of the Wolves, Iraq. It's a shockingly positive portrayal, perhaps a little bit too subtle for people that have that are graduates of the California public school system, but it really is quite disturbing. Bear in mind, again, that among the things this movie advocates or that it espouses is the notion of a modern blood libel, the notion that American and Jewish doctors are harvesting organs from Arab babies or Arab children who were kidnapped and killed in Iraq. This is how the Abbasi Program in Islamic Studies, the Middle East Collection of the Stanford University Library, and the Stanford Continuing Studies represented this shocking movie. An elite Turkish commando squad infiltrates the Kurdish region of U.S.-occupied Iraq. What they find is too shocking to contemplate. Their supposed American allies engaged in murder, extortion, organ dealing, and more. Not in our name, indeed. This film was a spin-off from a hugely popular Turkish TV series and went on to be one of the biggest grossing films in all Turkish cinema history. It has also enjoyed great popularity in Europe and the Middle East. It was due for a limited American release in December of 2006, but was quietly dropped at the last minute after a letter from the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith to the film's U.S. distributors objected to, quote, the incendiary anti-Jewish and anti-American themes and characters in the film, unquote. As a service to the Stanford academic community at large, we offer you the chance to see this important film for yourself. Non-stop screen action, intellectual stimulation, and real political controversy in one program. This is an event not to be missed. Screening at 1 p.m., followed by a discussion after the film. Well, the showing of this film was canceled because, thank God, some people who have not completely lost their senses raised objections to it. But I will reprint this press release in the description of the program. But basically what you're seeing, and what is being so benignly represented here, is the sort of venal propaganda that was routine in Nazi Germany, and that quite frankly is routine in much of the Arab and Muslim world. Egyptian state television during Ramadan of 2002 showed a made-for-TV series based on the protocols of the Elders of Zion. Anti-Semitic forgery as well as Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography, have been bestsellers in the Arab world for decades. And it's very disturbing indeed to see this sort of thing creeping its way into acceptance by people who really should know better. And indeed, it's interesting to watch the so-called progressive sector in this country, two of whose primary elements are feminists and gay rights activists espousing a culture in which... in reactionary Muslim culture is about as reactionary as it gets. It's not to say that all Muslims, maybe not even most Muslims, subscribe to that. But in much of the Arab and Muslim world, gays are murdered upon positive identification, in some countries as a matter of law. And where Sharia, where Islamic law is in effect, it is most profoundly repressive of women's rights. Side one, we talked about the Muslim Brotherhood's agenda in the early part of this decade to have sanitary napkin dispensers removed from public high schools, from girls' rooms in public high schools or women's rooms in public high schools in Egypt, because under reactionary Islamic doctrine, a menstruating woman is considered highly unclean and men aren't supposed to have any contact with them, presumably by removing sanitary napkin dispensers from the women's rooms in public high schools. That would force women to stay home when they were menstruating, so men wouldn't have any contact with them. Under Islamic law, it's for all practical purposes. Where Islamic law is literally implemented, it is for all practical purposes legal for a man to rape a woman. There have to be four male witnesses to the act for a man to be convicted of rape. Good luck with that. But, this is how you destroy yourselves, folks, is when you embrace what will annihilate you, well, the results sooner or later manifest themselves. And, again, to see to see a piece of filth like Valley of the Wolves, Iraq, given that glowing, glossy presentation by Stanford University is, well, it is most disturbing indeed. One of the areas in which the fascist Muslim Brotherhood and its advocates are being remade and repackaged as progressives concerns Tariq Ramadan. Tariq Ramadan is one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, arguably its most marketable leader, at least in European culture. Tariq Ramadan is the son of Saeed Ramadan, who set up the collaborative pattern between the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood during the Cold War. Saeed Ramadan also helped to cause the Muslim Brotherhood's diaspora from Egypt to Germany in order to reforge the link between the Nazis and the Muslim Brotherhood, something that was of great utility to the Nazis in the Middle East during the Second World War. Tariq Ramadan is also the son of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and in his schmoozing with Western intellectuals, Tariq Ramadan cites the, quote, anti-imperialist, unquote, agenda of his grandfather. His grandfather was not anti-imperialist. What he was looking to restore the caliphate. Those of you who use the Spitfire website might want to download the book Cairo to Damascus and also download the description for that I put on the website. There's actually a short interview that John Roy Carlson conducted with the late Hassan al-Banna. And if you think what you see there constitutes anti-imperialism, well, I feel sorry for you. Tariq Ramadan has been the focal point of considerable controversy. He has been repackaging himself and sort of reinventing himself as a liberating figure, and apparently is quite charismatic, very well-spoken, and a good-looking guy. He is also exemplary of the defense of the reactionary and specifically fascist Muslim Brotherhood by elements in the so-called progressive sector in this country. The American Civil Liberties Union has come to the defense of Tariq Ramadan, and when he was denied a visa to teach at Notre Dame University. For an objective opinion on Tariq Ramadan and for a good non-tainted view on Islamism, many of the French experts on Islamism would be a good reference point for people in this country who were feeling somewhat confused or disoriented. Unfortunately, in this country, you've got the Bush administration, which ostensibly is opposed to Al-Qaeda, but in fact, through the Saudi money axis and through the multi-transnational corporatist axis, is very closely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood. Grover Norquist, Karl Rove, Talat Atman, Samuel Arian et al., exemplary of that link. But the French have an Islamist problem. They also are certainly not in America's corner vis-a-vis some of its more foolish foreign policy adventures, such as the Iraq debacle. But the French also have an Islamist problem, and so some of the French experts, people like the authors of Forbidden Truth, and people like Gilles Kepel, Olivier Roy, also people like Roland Jacquard, these are people who certainly are not supportive of, quote, U.S. imperialism, unquote, or the Iraq War, and yet they also are not apologists for Islamism. And their views, I think, on the people like Tariq Ramadan and the Muslim Brotherhood are a useful weather vane for people who are feeling confused or disoriented between the altogether inadequate political discourse from both right and left in the United States. And the French experts on Islamism are not at all positive about Tariq Ramadan, but he again has been represented as a progressive force, and he's a very cunning individual. He uses the language of anti-imperialism, unquote, and even has managed to forge links with the Green and anti-globalization movement, despite the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is seen by the transnational corporations as the major vehicle for realizing globalism or for around the world, globalization around the world. Tariq Ramadan basically has learned to talk the talk, if not walk the walk. There was a recent interview with him in the New York Times. The Sunday magazine section of the New York Times for February 4th of this year, 2007, had an article by Ian Baruma titled, Tariq Ramadan Has an Identity Issue. And I'm just going to read one little interesting detail in this, which will, it sort of exemplifies how this guy has been able to represent himself as a wonderful guy. And it also, for those people who are regular listeners to this program, it'll be quite revealing. Speaking of Tariq Ramadan and quoting some of Tariq Ramadan's explanations about his own anti-imperialist struggles against dictatorship and colonialism, quote, I was also close to the Tibetans and spent 1 month with the Dalai Lama. It was the same philosophy, spiritual commitment and resistance in their case against Chinese colonialism. Perhaps because of these personal experiences, I started to read the work of my own grandfather who used the scriptures, the story of Moses against British colonialism, parenthetically Mein Kampf as well. He was saying in the 1940s, what the liberation theologists were saying in the 1960s, unquote. That, by the way, is just a flat-out lie. That is just not true. That is an L-I-E lie. But what is very revealing here is to watch how Tariq Ramadan cites the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans as fellow travelers and inspirations in the struggle against, quote, imperialism, unquote. Touching on something I brought up in the first part of the program, the big lie is a very difficult thing for people to grasp. And when something is, in fact, the exact opposite of the way it's represented, it's not easy for people to get to wrap around. The Dalai Lama is the exact opposite of what he represents himself as being and what he is represented as being. I refer people to the four-part series that I did. For the record program, numbers 547, 548, 549, and 550. In 547, Hello Dalai, I talked about the Dalai Lama's long association with Islamists, SS men, and others. In 540, I talked about what Tibet or not Tibet, what the old Tibet, the pre-Chinese invasion Tibet was like. And it's not to say I hold a brief for communist China or their general agenda, but actually as bad as they were a step up for Tibet. And Tibet was basically an enslaved society, and the lamas were among the main beneficiaries of that old social order. And indeed, the Dalai Lama has a history of association between Islamists, the agitation on behalf of which has been used to try to break up China. So when we see Tariq Ramadan, again, dissembling here and talking about his anti-imperialist, anti-colonial traditions, citing Hassan al-Banna as a role model in that regard. And when he brings up his association with the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans, well, just bear in mind that's actually far more consistent than people might think. And it sure as hell doesn't recommend anything whatsoever concerning Tariq Ramadan, but I thought that was very, very interesting and very possibly significant as well. One of the things that's unfortunate, not only about the Bush administration itself, but about the bald-faced lies that it's engaged in about September 11th and other things, and about the frankly inadequate job that the media, both the mainstream media and the so-called alternative media, have done in the non-investigation of September 11th, is opening up what has at least the potential to become a broad-based fascist political movement in this country, and yet one that represents itself as being opposed to fascism. In For the Record 584, Rewriting History, I discussed some of the fascist revisionist history that has been able to sort of ride on the coattails of the, quote, 911 truth, unquote, movement. By the way, there are individual researchers, including yours truly, are doing a great job investigating September 11th. But when I talk about the 911 truth movement, I'm talking about the controlled demolition, no plane hit the Pentagon freaks, and freaks they most assuredly are. Not only are there basic theses completely discredited. But now, too, the 9/11, quote, truth, unquote, movement is beginning to manifest some pretty ripe connections. And although there have always been X number of Holocaust deniers and fascists and anti-Semites present in that movement, they're beginning to gain greater visibility. In particular, one of the riper people in the so-called 9/11 truth movement is a person who, for all intents and purposes, is a neo-Nazi out of Santa Barbara named Eric Hufschmidt. The Pacifica station in New York, WBAI, wound up with a fair amount of egg on its face after having offered some of Hufschmidt's stuff as a marathon premium. Hufschmidt basically is a Nazi. And one of the things that's significant about the so-called 9/11 truth movement is the fact that one of its primary figures, a guy named James Fetzer, has been defending Eric Hufschmidt. A blog out of Phoenix, specifically the Phoenix New Times blog, talked about a recent 9/11, quote, truth, unquote, conference in Chandler, Arizona. From February 23rd of 2007, we read the following: Holocaust denier Eric D. Williams attends 9/11 accountability conference. Professor James Fetzer defends anti-Semite. Despite statements on 911accountability.org that Eric D. Williams had, quote, stepped down, unquote, from involvement in the 9/11 accountability conference, Williams was present today, Friday, at a press conference for the opening of the symposium at the Crown Plaza San Marcos in Chandler, and I have been informed that Williams will actually have a vendor booth at the conference on Saturday and Sunday. This is astonishing considering the controversy that swirled around Williams and the conference, since it was revealed that Williams had authored the Holocaust-denying tome The Puzzle of Auschwitz, which asserts that there were no killer gas chambers at Auschwitz and that there was no final solution planned and implemented by the Nazis against European Jews. Because of Williams' involvement, several speakers dropped out of the conference, including Dylan Avery, the boy wonder behind Loose Change, the one genuine star of the 9/11 conspiracy movement. In fact, I would add parenthetically, a person who produced a complete piece of BS, the Loose Change documentary, which is at least appropriately named. The fact that the conference headed by convicted felon Kent Cowkiller Knudsen has allowed Williams to participate despite disavowing him in the past and claiming wrongly that he had never been the conference director should completely discredit this conference and Knudsen and serve as proof of the conference's willingness to accept Holocaust deniers and anti-Semites into their midst. Further demonstrating the movement's tolerance of anti-Semites was panelist Jim Fetzer's defense of Eric Hufschmidt, whose erichufschmidt.net is filled with anti-Semitic tripe. Quote, this is quoting Jim Fetzer, who, by the way, along with Stephen Jones, is one of the founders of, quote, 9/11 Scholars for Truth, unquote, a misnomer if ever there was one. Quoting James Fetzer, in my opinion, Eric Hufschmidt's work, his book Painful Questions, for example, is an exemplar of excellence in research, unquote, asserted Fetzer at one point during the media event. Quote, he was a pioneer. He tackled this difficult subject. I realize that on various grounds he's a controversial guy. That part I'm not addressing. Then the blogger goes on to say, this freak Hufschmidt argues that, quote, Zionists, unquote, pull the strings of white supremacists in the U.S. He also states that, quote, the Jews are lying about the gas chambers and ovens, unquote. The Jews helped Hitler and the Nazi Party get control of Germany. The Jews instigated both world wars, and, quote, the Jews created anti-Semitism in Germany to drive Jews out of Europe and into Palestine, to unify Jews, and to bring pity to Jews, unquote. And this dude is an exemplar of excellence, unquote. Hey, don't hog, then the blogger goes on, hey, don't hog that tailpipe, Jim. Give me a whiff, too. Well, again, the guy who's presented that defense is the co-founder of 9/11 Scholars for Truth. His co-founder, by the way, Stephen E. Jones, late of Brigham Young University, is writing a book attacking Darwin. He's the sort of scientific expert, unquote, behind which the controlled demolition freaks have been advancing. He is a creationist and is writing a book attacking Darwin. That's some scientific expert, let me tell you. Very, very disturbing. Watch out for the, quote, 9/11 truth movement. There's a lot of very important things to be investigated there, but they not only aren't investigating it, but they're using lack of credibility of the official version to introduce a lot of fascist revisionist history. One of the things that has not received the attention due it, and that is the short selling that took place in the run-up to an immediate aftermath of September 11th. A lot of people made a lot of money selling short on the market. Apparently, this is not an unusual thing. The following article is from the Times of India of 14th of February 2007. Terrorists are manipulating stock exchanges to raise funds. That from the NSA, not meaning the National Security Agency, but National Security Advisor M.K. Narayanan of India. Manipulation of stock exchanges is the new modus operandi used by terrorist groups to raise funds for their operations, and fictitious companies have operated in the Mumbai and Chennai stock exchanges. Revealing this, National Security Advisor M.K. Narayanan has said some of these companies were later traced to terrorist groups. Isolated instances of terrorist outfits manipulating the stock markets to raise funds for their operations have been reported. Stock exchanges in Mumbai and Chennai have on occasions reported that fictitious or notional companies were engaging in stock market operations, unquote, he said while addressing his 43rd Conference on Security Policy in Munich last week. This entire article will be included in the written description for this program, and for the record, 327, where we controlled, goes into the short selling at great length. One of the interesting aspects vis-a-vis the stock market in September 11th, and that concerns the fact that in the summer of 2001, Bayer's pharmaceutical division experienced a huge downturn in its stock due to the fact that a high blood pressure treating medicine that it had marketed turned out to be dangerous. A number of people had died, and there were lawsuits that depressed the stock of Bayer's pharmaceutical division, which it was contemplating selling. However, that pharmaceutical division regained all of its value, for all intents and purposes, in the wake of the anthrax attacks, because Bayer markets the Cipro drug, which is used to treat anthrax. So the anthrax attacks restored the value to the stock of Bayer's pharmaceuticals division. Bayer, of course, one of the major companies of the old IG Farben complex. One of the heads of Bayer was Carl Duisberg, one of the major luminaries with the old IG Farben Nazi chemical cartel, and the individual for whom the Carl Duisberg Gesellschaft was named. It was the Carl Duisberg Gesellschaft that sponsored the entry of Mohammed Atta into the United States, and certainly into Germany and perhaps the United States. I received the following email, and I'm going to just read this email, and I'm going to put some supporting documentation into the description of the broadcast. It now appears, or this correspondent is alleging, that the Carl Duisberg Gesellschaft, or the Carl Duisberg Society, as its American branch is known, is very much involved with anthrax research in the United States. This correspondent alleges, "I was very interested to see your analysis of the link between the Carl Duisberg Society and Mohammed Atta. I see that it," meaning the program, "was last October, but I only recently read it. I would like to point out that the CDS connection provides the first viable link between Atta and the anthrax industry, which seemed anxious to take advantage of the terror attack. The Carl Duisberg Society works closely with the Fraunhofer Gesellschaft and Fraunhofer USA, which are German national dual-use technology laboratories. They are currently working on anthrax detection and anthrax vaccines, now at American expense as a result of the organizational ability of," unquote, "of Carl Steiner, himself a CDS alumni and credited with bringing Fraunhofer to the campus of the University of Delaware." So the Carl Duisberg Society apparently deeply involved with anthrax research in the U.S. and in Germany. That was who brought Atta certainly to Germany and possibly to the U.S. in the first place, as we've looked at in some of our talks with Daniel Hopsicker. That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 587, update on 9/11 and related matters. This has been recorded on February 25th of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.